This is lecture number 3 by Alan McRae on the prophecies of Daniel. I don't know whether I made the assignment for today altogether clear at the end of the last hour, but I posted it the next day on the bulletin board and hoped that people would read it. So I trust most of you saw it there. The assignment had 2 parts. You were to look through Daniel chapter 7 to see which verses are part of the vision and which are part of the interpretation, and also see which parts are figurative and which parts are literal. Most of you did very well. There were 2 or 3 from whom I expected good papers. I came to the conclusion that either they were not listening at the end of the hour to the assignment, or they did not see the assignment on the board, or, unfortunately, were much poorer in exegesis than what I thought because they simply gave me a general comparison of chapter 7 and chapter 2 as to the general course of events in both chapters. And that, of course, was not included in the assignment at all. That would not detract from the mark, but it couldn't add anything to it because they didn't deal with the 2 things I asked for, which were, which parts are part of the vision and which are literal? Which are parts of the vision and interpretation which are figurative and which are literal? Now, 1 or 2, I got the impression, didn't really understand what we mean by figurative or symbolic, and I think it's worth taking a minute or 2 on that right now to explain what the differences are. In Daniel chapter 2, we had a vision given, a vision or dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. And Daniel described the vision to Nebuchadnezzar in verses 31 to 35. And every single thing in that vision was figurative. It was a symbol. And as we have noticed, if you simply heard that vision, you couldn't have any idea what it really meant without an interpretation. They are symbols. They are figures. And unless you have seen the same figures used at some other time, you would have no way to approach the vision. You have to have an idea of what it's supposed to describe, and then you can make a comparison, without which you have no way to approach the vision. It is strictly figurative. Now, perhaps, strictly is just a little bit too strong, but mighty little, because the only thing I notice in it that is all literal is the statement at the end, quote, it filled the whole earth, end quote. Whatever it was, quote, filled the whole earth, end quote. Now that, of course, is a rather literal statement, but it could be part of a dream which he had. But up to that statement, there was a statue described. And as we've noticed, there were many things in the statue. We don't know just how many there were. We don't know how many fingers were visible. We don't have any reason to think the 2 arms and the chest had specific reference as to parts of the second kingdom or anything of the kind. We don't have any definite evidence as to the specific meaning of the first 3 metals. We are told that the 4th one indicates strength. But there are many things that are figures and maybe just part of the general picture. As to what parts of it do have meaning and what they mean, we would have no basis whatever to go on if we didn't have the interpretation. Of course, this is just a dream, and in the dream we did see a globe, and we saw a stone just flowing around and covering the whole globe, or did he simply see the stone enlarging so that it covered everything he could see? We just don't know exactly how the stone covered the globe that Daniel described in the vision. Now, when we get to the interpretation, we have a literal interpretation. And there we have to ask the question we just raised. What does the interpretation mean in that regard? But that is a question I don't want to take time to go into right now. The vision is all figure. It is all a symbol. And then we have the interpretation, which is separated by verse from the vision. The 2 are completely separate and distinct in Daniel chapter 2. And when you come to the interpretation in Daniel chapter 2, the interpretation is all, I believe, literal. That is to say, it contains an occasional repetition of phrases. For example, quote, whereas you saw this, that means this, end quote. Or perhaps something like, whereas you saw that, here's what that means, end quote. And the full meaning may not be totally explained, but you could infer things sometimes. But except for repetitions, this description of the vision is entirely literal. Now, when you come to chapter 7, the situation is very different. So different that I have made a statement, a list, of chapter 7 that I think would be interesting for you to look at. In chapter 7, the vision runs from verse 2 to verse 14, and that vision is figurative except for the last verse of it. The last verse would seem to be, quite definitely literal, but the rest of it is clearly figurative. I say this with the possible exception of much of verses 9, 10, and 13. There are certain questions in those three verses as to just what is literal and what is figurative. Now, the vision in chapter 7 runs from verses 2 to 14. I think that is quite obvious. And it is all figurative except for the last verse, except verse 14, when it says in verse 14, quote, "There was given him dominion and glory and the kingdom that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, in his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed." End quote. That is a pretty literal statement. Now, how would you see that in a vision and yet still be part of the vision? Perhaps a voice said it and he heard it, but we don't know. At any rate, it is quite a literal statement. But the rest of the vision is figurative, except in verses 9, 10, and 13. There are certain statements on which we might have a question, and we will look at them later when we look at more in detail. But then, a very interesting thing in chapter 7 is that the interpretation which is given is part of the vision. You notice I said here that the interpretation is in the vision itself. The whole thing was a vision that Daniel had. But in the vision, we read that in Daniel chapter 7, as verse 16 says, quote, "I came near to one of those that stood by and asked him the truth of all this, and he told me and made known to me the interpretation of it," end quote. So then we have an interpretation given, which is only three verses. And these three verses are literal with the possible exception, I don't think it is really one, but with the possible exception of a phrase at the end of chapter 7, verse 17. And then the strange thing here is that he's been given this very brief interpretation, which quickly summarizes the whole thing. Then in verse 19, we find that Daniel expresses a desire for more information, and the angel repeats a part of the vision. And as he repeats a part of the vision, he gives a little more detail than he had given before. So we have a further description of part of the vision in verses 19 to 22. Verses 19 to 20 are figurative, clearly figurative. And verses 21 to 22 are mostly literal. And then, in answer to this further question, which gave us further repetition in part and additional information in part to what we've seen already in the vision, then we should have an interpretation from verses 23 to the first part of verse 28, which is strictly literal. It's interesting to see how different it is from the very simple arrangement that we had in chapter 2. Now, that was the assignment for today, to compare chapter 2 and chapter 7, and now we go back to chapter 2 to pick up a few more things about that chapter. In chapter 2, we're looking at capital E, quote, "the fifth part of the statue," end quote. I had just a couple of lines here that were on the last sheet that I brought to class, but unfortunately I did not bring it with me this time. Under capital E, however, note the symbolic meaning of the potter's clay. It is weak and brittle. I gave you number 3, didn't I, last time? Yes, that's number 3 under capital E, and that was, quote, "Does the statement in verse 43 simply mean an unintegrated mixture of peoples?" End quote. And under that I mentioned small a, quote, "If so, it will fit the whole history of each of these empires," end quote. That is, all three empires had unintegrated mixtures of peoples. The Babylonians not only conquered many nations, but they mixed the peoples of the nations together. They carried off people from one section to another, and from that to a third, and so on. And so they were all mixed. So the statement in verse 43 about the feet being mixed with iron and clay says specifically in verse 43 that, quote, "Whereas you saw iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay," end quote. The mixture of iron and clay is clearly a statement that this mixture is to be weak or brittle, but this verse seems to go beyond that. The most simple suggestion of this statement is that it is an unintegrated mixture of people. But if so, it would fit the Babylonian Empire, and it would also fit the Persian Empire, which conquered many kingdoms in which they were mixed together to some extent. It would fit the Hellenistic Empire, which conquered the whole Persian Empire and made a great conglomeration of peoples with a small group of Greeks or Macedonians controlling the whole. It would certainly fit the Roman Empire. And so it doesn't seem to be anything distinctive if all it means is an undifferentiated mixture of people, except that perhaps the mixture became greater between 400 and 600 AD than before, because at that time, Germanic tribes were marching back and forth across the Roman Empire, pillaging and destroying and settling down here and there. But there had been Germanic peoples entering the Roman Empire for the previous six centuries, but entering in small groups and being assimilated. So it might fit that period a little bit better, but it could fit any period, quite frankly. But I have here small letter B, quote, "the possibility remains that it points to some factor that is not obvious," end quote. I didn't give it that, did I? Let me read verse 43 again to you as it stands in the King James Version. Quote, "And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave on to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay," end quote. Some have tried to show that it points out intermarriage and ruling families. Well, there was a lot of that in all the kingdoms, in every single one of them, so that certainly wouldn't be a distinctive feature. There was that in just about every period. And so that wouldn't be distinctive of the last part of the verse, the mixture of the iron and the clay. It's a peculiar statement, I think, and it may simply mean an unintegrated or undifferentiated mixture of people, which became more pronounced from 400 to 600 AD than ever before. Or it may include some element that is not clear to us. And if any of you have any good suggestions as to what they might be, I wish you would write them out and give them to me. I confess that as of the present, I am not sure if it does represent something more than that, but the peculiar language suggests it does to me very strongly. But what it is, I do not know. Now we go on to number 4 of the outline. Quote, "The marked similarity of this part, that is the fifth part of the image, the feet and the toes," end quote. The marked similarity of this part to the condition of the Roman Empire between AD 400 and 600 should be noted. I just mentioned that fact. At that time, you had the western half of the Roman Empire being crisscrossed by various barbarian tribes, conquering, pillaging, destroying, settling down for a time in one area, moving to another. You have a condition of intermixture of peoples far greater than ever before. You have a weakness along with strength. You have the violence of the conquering tribes. You have a certain amount of strength remaining in the Roman Empire, but not much strength in that period of time. What it did have came from some of these peoples, from the Germanic tribes who took service under the Roman leaders, and they gave what real strength there was in the Roman Empire during this time. But its name and its reputation, i.e., the Roman Empire, still carried a great deal of weight. It's a period we can speak of as iron mixed with clay. It's a period of great intermingling of peoples. There is a marked similarity of those two centuries to what is described in Daniel chapter 2. Now number 5 of the outline. Verse 14 says that, quote, "The stone strikes the statue upon its feet of iron and clay," end quote. Now, in a symbolic picture, there are apt to be many elements that are just part of the picture and don't convey a meaning, like the two arms, possibly 10 fingers. We don't know whether the fingers are shown or not, or whether Nebuchadnezzar noticed them or not, if they were shown. We don't know whether the arms were longer than usual or shorter than usual. But there were the normal features of the statue that we think a statue should have: head, torso, arms, legs, feet. So to have a meaning, you need an interpretation, unless you have a feature that is very, very unusual. Like you have the unusual feature here of having different metals. Now, the metals themselves may not have a specific meaning, but the fact that you have a different set of metals certainly is an unusual thing, which does have meaning. And there is a change from one empire to the other that is represented by the change in the metals in the statue. Well, now, the stone strikes the statue where he specifically said, quote, "upon its feet of iron and clay," end quote. And since the statue represents a progression of events, when it is specifically said that the stone strikes the statue on the feet of iron and clay, That would suggest very strongly that the event described by the hitting of the statue by the stone and demolishing it were something that would take place in the fifth period, in the fifth part of the statue, rather than one of the first four. That is, it seems to me, it is quite obvious that there are those who do not like the idea at all. I noticed in one commentary here that the statement is made, quote, "The striking of the feet is symbolical and does not necessarily have any particular reference to the fourth kingdom. The image is struck on the feet because such a blow will cause it to totter and fall." Where else would one strike a blow that would cause the entire image to fall? Well, that is a case where a man has a certain interpretation and he wants to stand for it, and therefore he tries to twist everything in line with this interpretation, or to explain away anything that doesn't fit with his interpretation. Now, this particular commentary, I'm not criticizing greatly on this account. It is a little worse than a good many commentaries in this direction. But people approach with a definite idea in mind, and then they try to fit everything into their idea, or to explain away what doesn't seem to fit. It specifically said that the stone strikes the image upon its feet that are made of iron and clay. Why does it bother to tell us where it strikes? Why not just say that it struck the image and destroyed it? It seems likely that for some reason saying where it hits the image is important. But more than that, hitting it on the feet is a very unusual and strange thing. If one of you were standing here and for some reason I wanted to demolish you, I can't imagine that I'd pick up a stone and try to hit you in the feet. I think that would be the last place I would think of aiming at. And if you were a statue here and I wanted to knock it over, I might hit it in the head, or in the chest, perhaps even the legs, but I can't imagine that I would hit it in the feet in order to knock it over. It is so obvious that it is something unusual that is said here, something that is strange, and is so specifically named here that it is rather ludicrous when a commentator tries to get rid of it by a statement such as the one I made previously. Where else would you hit to knock over a statue? Well, I think anywhere except in the feet. That would be the least likely place that you would ever hit it. So we notice that as a specific fact about the fifth part of the statue, that verse 34 says, that is where the stone strikes the statue, on its feet of iron and clay. Now, that is capital E, and we now go on to capital F, which I have with me here, and we can observe capital F. It is, quote, "the dynamic series of events," end quote. We have been looking at the parts of the statue, the set figure that we saw. But now, as we notice, things begin to move. There is a dynamic series of events. Now, let's look at the biblical statements about these, and here I have reference to the sheet that I gave you. This was the assignment last week, for you to look at them and see how the statements related to each of these three events, which we have already noticed are here. The three events are the origin of the stone, the effect of the stone upon the statue, and the enlargement or growth of the stone after it hits the statue. And so here I have taken verses 34 to 35 and verses 44 and 45. I've simply taken the King James version of those verses and I have arranged them to indicate which relate to these three events. You'll notice that in the account of the events, well, first there's an introduction. Here it is, quote, "Thou sawest until ... end quote. That connects it with the previous statements. He's looking at the image, then he sees these events begin to happen. The first of these is the origin of the stone. The stone was cut without hands. Then we have the effect of the stone. It strikes the image and completely demolishes the image. And it uses very strong language to show how every part of the image gets all mixed together and carried off so there's nothing left of it. And then I indicated by capital G here, quote, "the growth of the stone," end quote. That is the third part of the vision, but in the interpretation it begins with the introductory phrase, quote, "in the days of these kings," end quote. Then the origin is rather summarized that, quote, "the God of heaven will set up a kingdom," end quote. That's not merely the origin, it summarizes the whole thing, you might say. But it specifically deals with the first and the last part of what the stone is doing, where it comes from, what happens to the image after it is struck by the stone. It is the God of heaven who sets up the kingdom, but the stone filling the whole earth is paralleled by the fact that the kingdom God sets up will never be destroyed, and that kingdom will not be left to other people. But then, the explanation goes on in verse 44 to tell about the demolition of the statue, that it will break it in pieces, and that it shall consume all the kingdoms the statue represents. And, of course, we do not take that altogether literally. It does mean that the people of these kingdoms are all broken in pieces, but it doesn't mean that the land is all broken in pieces or their buildings are all broken in pieces. It means the characteristic features of these kingdoms are all demolished. Everything that was represented by the gold, the bronze, the silver, and the iron and clay is demolished. Everything that is typified by Nebuchadnezzar's empire and these other empires which rule over the whole earth, most of them in defiance to God, most of them in utter disregard to his righteous law, they were to be broken in pieces and consumed. And then we have a reiteration of the fact, quote, and it shall stand forever, end quote. That is, the kingdom established after the stone strikes the image will last forever. But then we go back to the origin again by simply repeating the statements of the visions. Quote, for as much as you saw the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, end quote. And then a repetition of the destruction of the statue and that it broke in pieces, the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, all broken to pieces. And then there is a final conclusion. Now, I just have to say a word about the first phrase in the interpretation, quote, in the days of these kings, end quote. You ask immediately, quote, what kings, end quote. And you find many commentaries which tell you that they are kings who are described in chapter 7. Well, it is quite unbelievable that Daniel, in the time of Nebuchadnezzar, speaking to Nebuchadnezzar, would use a phrase which was referring to something that was not revealed to Daniel until 45 years later. We can use a later revelation to throw light on an earlier revelation, but we cannot read it back into the earlier revelation. My purpose in this course is not to find what the Scripture teaches about the future. My purpose is certainly not to give you my interpretation of all these events that are described. My purpose is to go through these events with you, carefully seeing exactly what is clear and definite, and what there is on which we perhaps do not know the answer, and would have to wait until further revelation to find out what the answer is. And so when here it says, quote, in the days of these kings, end quote, the only reasonable interpretation would be that it means the kings already mentioned, and it was mentioned in the time of Nebuchadnezzar. And then it has mentioned kingdoms that follow him. Now the terms king and kingdom are sometimes interchanged. They are rather loosely used in Scripture, whether referring to the man or referring to the whole kingdom over which the man rules. And in this case, the whole context would seem to require that when he says, quote, in the days of these kings, end quote, he means within the time represented by these four kingdoms and the fifth, whether it be part of the fourth or whether it be a separate kingdom, we don't know. That's not made clear in this chapter, but it is made clear in chapter 7. In either case, it is in the days of the kings that we have been talking about. Now, there are commentaries that say something like, quote, of course this is referring to the 10 toes. They represent 10 kings. And in the days of the 10 kings, represented by the 10 toes, all this is going to happen when the stone strikes the statue, end quote. Methodologically, that is reading too much into this statement. It is only 45 years later that anything is revealed about the number 10 in connection with the fifth part of the vision. And so we are not warranted in reading that back into chapter 2. Now, if there was a statement made, for example, there were 10 toes, something to call attention specifically to the toes, that might perhaps give a little warrant for such an interpretation that the 10 toes represent 10 kings. But unless you have a statement specifically to that effect, it is very hazardous to read something like that into a picture. We may find that taught in chapter 7, but I don't believe we can read it back into chapter 2. So we must beware then of taking a view that has been adopted and reading it into what is not there, either by saying 10 toes, the number of which is not mentioned here, and nothing said about the toes having a specific meaning, any more than the fingers, or the nose, or the eyes, or any part, to now say that had a meaning at that time, or on the other hand, to say when it specifically says something unusual, that it struck it upon the feet that were of clay and iron, and just say something like, quote, well, where else would you strike the statue to knock it over, end quote. They are both reading into a previously established system. Now, we do not want to read anything in, but to read out what we find there. And so we go on from there to look specifically at these three events, and we look at number two, quote, the origin of the stone, end quote. And as to the origin of the stone, all that is said on the sheet that I gave you this morning is that the origin of the stone was cut without hands. This was Daniel's account in the vision. But in his interpretation, he says, quote, for as much as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, end quote, it does not say that the stone was a new creation. It doesn't say something like, quote, something came into existence that did not exist before, end quote. But it does say it was cut out. There is a new phrase. At least, there is a new form. There is a new representation in some way. A stone was cut out without hands. A stone was cut out of the mountain without hands. We can very clearly draw from this the teaching that the origin of the stone is entirely supernatural. It is cut without hands. It is not something that any human being or human force could produce. Now, the early church fathers felt that in this verse there was quite a definite reference to the virgin birth. I'm not sure we can be quite as certain as they were. We must certainly mention as a possibility that the stone cut out without hands refers to the supernatural birth of the Lord Jesus Christ. It is certainly a possibility, but that is something on which we certainly should not speak dogmatically, at least not at this point. Now, the second of these dynamic events is, of course, number three, quote, the effect on the statue, end quote. And the effect on the statue we have rather fully described in the picture in verses 34 and 35, and also at the end of the interpretation in verse 45. It breaks the statue in pieces. All of the different parts of the statue are broken. And it breaks the statue into tiny pieces so that the wind carries them away and there's nothing left of them. The completeness of the destruction is surely emphasized here. This certainly does not represent something that is going to take place in certain sections of the world, scattered here and there. It is something that completely eradicates the previous situation. The completeness of the destruction is stressed just about as thoroughly as anything can be stressed. There is in this an end to all that the statue symbolizes, all the human glory, all of the human clever organizations, all of human violence, all of human autocracy, all the things that are represented by the different parts of the statue. It is not merely the fifth part of the statue that is destroyed, they are all destroyed. Well, how can they all be destroyed when the Babylonian Empire came to an end, at least many, many centuries before the vision where the stone strikes the image? Because the qualities of the kingdoms are much the same throughout. There is a difference of name, there is a difference of language, there is a difference of culture, but that which is symbolized by Nebuchadnezzar's control and the activities of his government are all found in the Persian government also, and are found in the Hellenistic government and the Roman government. Different forms, many places, varying amounts of freedom on the part of individuals among themselves, varying at different times within these governments. But there is always that fact that big government, autocracy, and control over the lives of people are often mixed with wrath and with corruption and with violence and with clever human organization. The clever human planning is characteristic of these empires, and we are told that it is completely demolished, completely destroyed by the stone. So the completeness of the destruction is one thing that is very greatly stressed here. And now we move on to number four, the growth of the stone. It is made very definite that the stone demolishes the image, completely destroys it, and then the stone grows until it fills the whole earth. Well, the picture seems to be a picture of a rapid change. But it does not say that the stone grows at lightning speed until it fills the whole earth. It does not say even that the stone cut out of the mountain comes at lightning speed to hit the statue. Neither of those statements is made. And so, while it is absolutely clear that it fills the whole earth and that the statue and all that it stands for is completely demolished, we have a question. Is the growth gradual or rapid? A question which we cannot say dogmatically is answered in this juncture of the picture. And then there is another question. When does the growth of the stone begin? Does the stone begin to enlarge to fill the whole earth only after the entire statue has been demolished, or does the growth of the stone begin at an earlier time? That we cannot be dogmatic about either, from the picture or from the interpretation. And that finishes capital F, so now we go on to capital G of the outline. G now gets us to various attempts at relating these dynamic events of the stone to history. Now, I have called capital G, quote, relating these dynamic events to history, end quote. I have not said, quote, relating the whole prophecy to history, end quote, because the four kingdoms are pretty clear. We have a long history about which we know many facts, and we have many remarkable points fitting together between the picture, as shown here, and the events during 1,000 years after the time of Daniel. And so we are particularly interested in attempts now to relate the dynamic events into history. And first we note the view of the critics. This is the view which was published in the 2nd or 3rd century AD by Porphyry, a view which was denied and attacked by Christian writers in the next few centuries, but which within the last 2 or 3 centuries has been adopted by most of the so-called higher critics, and even by many who would not wish to be called higher critics. There are many commentaries on Daniel which adopt this view, the view of the critics, and according to this view, the book of Daniel was not really written in the time of Nebuchadnezzar, but was written some 400 years later. According to this view, it was written at the time when a Syrian king, one of the Hellenistic empires, tried to put a complete end to the Jewish religion. This is Antiochus Epiphanes. There was great persecution involved in this time, and the group of Jews fled to the wilderness to wage war against the Syrians. There they gathered together into bands which attacked the various parts of the Syrian control and eventually won complete freedom for Judea, a freedom which lasted for about a century. And these leaders became known as the Maccabees, and so this period we can well speak of as the time of the Maccabees, and according to the critical view, which is held by all the critics and by some who would not call themselves critics, the book of Daniel was written by someone in that period and made out to be a prophecy when it was really his knowledge of history. And thus he portrayed as if he was predicting something 400 years earlier, and the course of events lead up to the time that he is writing this book, again, around the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, around the time of about 170 BC. And then when you get to this time, it goes on in the prophecy, and what it contains is only wishful hopes. He believed, or at least he tried to make people believe, that they were to be delivered from their difficulties by God intervening and completely destroying this wicked power that was trying to destroy them. And so that is the view, and it's surprising to find some who are thought of as earnest Christians representing this view in their commentaries. For instance, as I mentioned before, F. W. Farrar, the author of The Life of Christ, which is highly regarded as a commentary on Daniel, in which he takes this view. The same is true of Moses Stuart. Both of these people have written some very fine Christian material, but they take this view regarding Daniel. I personally don't see how they can, because the New Testament definitely takes the attitude, as Christ definitely takes the attitude, that the Old Testament is entirely true and reliable. When you look at the history, that is a great difficulty with this critical view. According to this view, the time of the Maccabees has to be the fourth kingdom, and according to history, it's only the third kingdom. Nebuchadnezzar, as you have the sheet that I gave you last week, Nebuchadnezzar's empire was succeeded by the Persian Empire, which lasted for 2 centuries, and then by the Hellenistic Empire. And so we have 3 empires, and the Romans came later, and they are the 4th empire, and there are 4 empires in this picture. And either a 5th or a 2nd part of the 4th, we don't know. And so that is a very great difficulty with this critical theory. It imagines a Median empire between the Babylonian and the Persian empires, though the book of Daniel specifically tells us that the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar was given to the Medes and the Persians, and it puts the Medes and the Persians together as one empire, not two empires. So by summary, this is the problem with the critical view. The critical view wants to separate the Medes and the Persians into two empires, when the scriptures definitely state that the Medes and the Persians are one empire. Now, a second view, which you will not find in any commentary as far as I know, is the obvious view that it might be seen as AD 750 if the New Testament were left out of consideration. In AD 750, a person who knew nothing about the New Testament could look at this picture in Daniel and say, quote, there's the Babylonian Empire conquered by the Persian Empire, conquered by the Hellenistic Empire, and then conquered by the Roman Empire, end quote. And the Roman Empire stood there for as long as the two preceding ones put together. In fact, longer than the two preceding ones, maybe as long as the other three put together. It was a great, powerful empire until about AD 400. And then between AD 400 and 600, you have a period when the Roman Empire was largely broken into pieces. And when these German tribes were going through, seizing this part and that part and the other part of the empire, and at AD 400, the probabilities are that, let us say, 3/4 of the people in the Roman Empire could read and write. Then by about AD 500, at least in the Western Empire, I doubt if one person in 30 could read and write. There was a tremendous decline in every aspect of civilization during those years between AD 400 and 600. And then, at AD 600, there came a new force into the world, a force which its followers believed was a supernatural force. Muhammad declared that God had sent him. He declared there is one God, and Muhammad was his prophet. And he declared that all people should turn to believe in this one God. And after preaching this for a number of years and getting about 8 or 10 converts and being in danger for his life in Mecca, finally he fled from Mecca and went to Medina, and there he started a new system, starting to force people to adopt his view. And he filled the Arab tribes with enthusiasm for his teaching and also for the plunder that they were getting, and the armies marched out shortly after AD 600, and within a very few years, most of the Eastern Empire had been conquered. The new Persian force that had developed had been completely overcome. All of North Africa had been overrun, and Spain had been taken, and it looked as if the whole world was going to fall into their hands. And so here you had something which its believers felt was a supernatural thing, something which seemed about to completely destroy the empires which preceded it, which seemed about to grow so it would fill the whole earth with its teaching. And so you have the obvious view, as it would appear to someone living in AD 750, if the New Testament is left out of the consideration. But you have here too a great difficulty, just as we had with the critical view. The difficulty is that what appeared to be the case in AD 750 no longer appears to be the case today. There was this tremendous spread of Islam, this tremendous spread of Mohammedism, which held the land of Israel for 800 years. Jerusalem was in Muslim hands, which spread over a large part of the world and which looked as if it was going to conquer the whole world. But eventually, it became weak, and today we have comparatively little power in the world if it were not for the money that is received from oil. It is today a comparatively weak force in the world, and so there is something which might have appeared to be precisely the fulfillment of what Daniel says about the stone striking the feet of the statue, but which does not work out. Now, we'll look at other interpretations. I was hoping to get to them today. We will not, however, get to any conclusion as to the correct interpretation today of chapter 2, but we'll look forward next time to further evidence from other sections. This ends lecture number 3 of Alan McCrae's The Prophecies of Daniel.